Ready.
Okay. So I'd like to call this February 16, 2023 meeting of the Arizona State Board of Optometry to order at 8:02. Agenda item B, roll call. Ms. Becker, will you please call roll?
Thank you, Madam President. Dr. Mastoris?
Here.
Dr. Cohen?
Present.
Dr. Carpenter?
Present.
Dr. Brown?
Here.
Dr. Moffitt?
Present.
Ms. Galan? Ms. Galan? Okay, noted absent. Mr. Hamed?
Present.
And staff, Director Whalen?
Present.
Ms. Becker? Present. And legal counsel, Mona Bascom?
Good morning, present.
Hi. And Madam President, we do have a quorum.
Thank you. Agenda item C, board purpose statement. The board meeting statement of purpose, a license to practice optometry in the state, is a privilege granted by the Arizona legislature through the Optometric Practice Act. In 1907, on behalf of the people of the state, the legislature created the Arizona State Board of Optometry to regulate the practice of the profession of optometry, issue licensure where appropriate, and in general, assure the public that the practice of optometry will be conducted with reasonable skill and safety by persons who meet the curriculum requirements to hold a Doctor of Optometry degree from an accredited optometry school. To enforce the Optometric Practice Act, the board reviews applications for licensure and complaints relative to the conduct of its licensed optometrists and is charged with determining if the provisions of the Optometric Practice Act are met. In addition, the board may promulgate rules and policies in conformity with the stated purpose of the board and the mission as mandated by law. As of January 1, 2019, all board meetings are digitally recorded with the recordings of the audio available to the public on the board's website under the consumer information link. Agenda item D, declaration of conflicts of interest, if any, for this meeting. Are there any conflicts of interest to declare today?
This is Dr. Mastoris. I have a conflict for 202415.
Okay, thank you. Any others? Okay. Agenda item E, President's report. I have no report for today's meeting. Agenda item F, review, discussion, and possible action on investigative reviews and complaints. As this is a virtual and telephonic meeting, I'd like to request all participants to preface their comments with their name so that everyone knows who's speaking. And then also, when referring to a patient, please use their initials only. So we'll start with agenda item F1, Fong Nguyen, IR number 202410. I see Dr. Nguyen is present. Great. And then is
yes.
Patient AC present?
Yeah.
Okay. And any counsel for Dr. Nguyen? Okay. So we'll proceed with the board summary. If I could ask one of the board members, please, to summarize this case first.
This is Dr. Cohen. I'd be happy to provide a brief summary.
Thank you.
On November 21st of 2023, patient AC had an exam of Dr. Nguyen. Over the course of that, progressively, patient AC smelled alcohol that appeared to be coming from Dr. Nguyen's breath. Dr. Nguyen denied any alcohol use during work time, had any alcohol since December 31st of 2022, and stated that she has a tendency to have an allergic reaction with alcohol, and denied that there was any alcohol that she had to drink, nor is there any in her office, and that she never has done so.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. I'll ask one more time, is patient AC present? Okay. Dr. Nguyen, would you like to take a moment and address the board?
Yes. I have no idea why she thought that I was drinking alcohol. I was just being myself, and basically I'm pretty allergic to alcohol. As soon as I drink like one little sip, my face just turns completely red and I basically throw up right away. So that's really all I have to say, unless any other questions for me.
Okay. This will conclude open discussion, and now I'll open it up for board discussion only. And then, Dr. Nguyen, if we have questions for you, we'll just address you specifically, okay?
Sounds good.
Everyone who's on the meeting, please remember to mute your microphone just so we don't pick up background noise from others. So I'd like to open this up for board discussion. Any comments from the board members?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I'll just comment. I did review all the character witness letters that were provided by Dr. Nguyen, which was helpful. And just reading that information, it just seems very hard to believe that she would be drinking alcohol at work. And so I don't have any concerns here.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. Other comments?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen, and I'm very empathetic to Dr. Nguyen, because this is a situation in which a very serious accusation is being made, and clearly I see no violation of statutes, because separate from the character references and her own comments, there's absolutely no proof that she had been drinking or in any way was impaired. And I just want to point out the issue to all of us, In the fact that this patient, instead of saying, I have a concern about this and discussing it, felt maybe I should leave and just write a bad review, which is concerning when you see an accusation that in this case appears to be unfounded, to then go to social media and put that out into the universe, without having addressed the issue in the office first. So I clearly see no violation and feel badly that this even happened.
This is Dr. Mastoris. I completely agree. My first thought was maybe it was like the alcohol pad swabs that she was smelling. But I feel that this is unfounded, and I see no violation of the Optometric Act.
Thank you. Further comments, Mr. Hamed, any comments? Dr. Brown, comments?
This is Sammy Hamed. As a layperson, I understand where she may have thought that, but to make an accusation like that against Dr. Nguyen is pretty substantial and should not be done lightly in this case, which it was by the patient. And therefore, I don't see a violation of the act or of her conduct, actually. So therefore, I'm going to vote to dismiss this complaint when a motion is made.
Thank you. Dr. Brown, any comments?
Yes, I agree with everyone's comments, and I make a motion that we dismiss this complaint.
Okay.
I'll second.
I'm sorry, who was the second?
Sammy Hamed, I'll second.
Thank you, Mr. Hamed. Any further discussion? I'll just add my thoughts real quickly to the board comments that I understand the patient had a concern, and I'm glad that the patient brought the concern before us. However, it seems unfounded, and so I'm sorry, Dr. Nguyen, that this happened to you.
Thank you.
Everything else that's been said. So we've had a motion and a second now to dismiss the complaint against Dr. Nguyen. We'll vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastoris?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0.
Thank you.
So we'll move forward now to complaint F2, Dr. Randall Paul, IR number 202411. I see that Dr. Paul is present. Is patient SH present? Okay, I see no response. And then also counsel for Dr. Paul.
No, just me. I'm here, Randall Paul.
Okay, all right. So can I have a board summary, please, for Dr. Paul, IR number 202411?
This is Dr. Brown. Patient SH complains that she has not received copies of her records after repeated requests. Dr. Paul responds by saying that he and his staff have made multiple attempts to find the records and have failed to find them. He theorizes they may be lost, misfiled, or erroneously destroyed. This is an unfortunate situation, and I guess I'll leave the summary at that point.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Brown. I'll ask one more time. Patient SH present? No. Dr. Paul, would you like to take a moment to address the board regarding this complaint?
Yes, thank you. I would. This is an unfortunate scenario. I've never had to deal with this, and I've been in practice for a long time and had to deal with these are paper charts we're talking about. I've had a store and storage and maneuver paper charts for most of my career. I've done a good job out of it. They get shredded after about 12 years. They stay in storage buildings until it's time to be shredded. In this particular case, the patient came in and wanted old records. We had to figure out where they were in the storage building. This did take a while, so I do apologize for the length of time she had to wait for us to try to retrieve records, but they're in a storage building offsite. I went to the building the first time to look for her boxes, couldn't find them, brought back the closest boxes I could to the date range, had the staff look through those, contact the patient, said we're having trouble finding them. She was adamant that she wanted them. The problem is that this got into about June and July of last year. As you all recall, it was very hot. The storage building is not air conditioned. I had to go back there twice because I really did want to find her records. I have to unstack boxes in a hallway, et cetera, et cetera. So the long story is there was no way I could find the boxes dated when they should be for her. And in speaking with the staff at Pearle Vision, we did know that there was a period about the time that this box would have been that one of our managers mistakenly sent four boxes to the shred company, Iron Mountain Shredding, because they're in a storage room with stuff that should be shredded. And she just said, oh, all the white boxes go. And we're pretty sure that there's about four boxes at that time frame that got shredded. And that would be the date range that I cannot find for this patient, SH. I'm not sure what to say about that. I was upset as anybody. It was a big event when that happened, when we found shredded boxes. We changed some procedures at work so that that would never happen again. We have Iron Mountain install little shred boxes with slots on them now so that only papers you know are going in the slots are to be shredded. It's the only time that ever happened in my whole career. The patient's upset about it. I'm upset about it. The manager that actually approved the boxes to be shredded and just said, take all those boxes, is no longer with us. So I don't know what else to say as far as violating the Optometry Act for storing records. This is tricky. I don't think I have. It wasn't my doing to send the boxes to the shred company. And I did everything I could to regulate or to fix the problem so we would never have that again. So I guess unless there's questions, that's all I can say as a recap.
Thank you, Dr. Paul. So this will conclude open discussion, and now we'll open it up for board discussion. Comments from board members?
Dr. Paul, I have a question. Do you know if it was like a threshold visual field she was looking for, or was it FDT?
Well, yes. So at that time frame, we had all patients had the FDT. That's what I used that's the equipment we had. And that's pretty good for screening for problems. So we did that on every single patient. And we did tell the patient, she was wondering if we had electronic records of that. Well, that equipment doesn't store any files. So we would just place in the file patient passed or failed. And if they failed, we bring them back, do another screening and do a threshold if needed. And again, I couldn't tell you if any of that, I assume all that was done, but we don't have records to look at.
Yeah. Well, I sympathize with the situation, and I know it can be hard to, I mean, the fact that how much you've gone through to store files in general, you provided a lot of proof, even the images of the boxes that were destroyed. So I thank you for providing all that. We'll see what everyone else says.
I'll offer a few comments here just to start. So I think that it's an unfortunate situation. I think we all agree with that for the patient's part in it and the doctor's part in it. The problem is there's a responsibility to maintain the records. And so that has to be determined who's responsible and for what. So So it looks like going through this complaint, there were two issues. One was the lack of response. The patient detailed, I think, 5 or 6 different attempts to get records and had a difficult time. It really shouldn't go like that. It's not supposed to go like that when you request your records. The practice has an obligation to provide them to you. And I think, Margaret, was it 6 days? Is that right? You have 6 days from written request?
5 days
mm-hmm. from written request. So that clearly didn't happen here. So that is issue number one, as far as I see it. And then issue number two is who was responsible if Dr. Paul sold the practice in, was it 2018, Dr. Paul?
2017. Okay. And maybe just a quick comment on your comment. And I did not like the communication of this myself. The patient didn't give us written requests for records. These are all phone calls and often to different people. She would call in and talk to a tech, a staff person, multiple staff people. I would get a sticky note that the patient's trying to get this record. We did send initially, we had some records on file that were electronic. So the first time she called, those got sent to her within days. It's just those are not the older ones that she wanted. So we did send records to her immediately. And then it went into the search for where's all these other records.
Okay.
And back to your question. Yes. So I ceased to own the business in 2017. And per record storage, I was concerned when I sold the business that those records would be maintained, that they would still be paid for at the storage facility. And I actually had my attorney put a carve out specifically in our sales agreement that the new company would be responsible for records, make sure they maintain them the same way that I did and obey the Optometry Act for keeping the records safe and secure. So I did think about that ahead of time, making sure records were stored properly.
Sure. Well, and I appreciate that. It's part of our responsibility if you sell a practice that you notify the patients right and that you try to maintain those records best you can. But the responsibility does shift to the new owner. So who is the new owner?
Well, the owner is so I was a franchise, Pearle Vision franchise. So I sold the business to a larger franchise, multi-state unit. And so that's West Point Optical Group, LLC. And then they have a subgroup, which are the doctors, Family First Vision Arizona. And that is the doctors group that I'm employed by.
Thank you, Dr. Paul.
Yes.
So, Margaret, this is a question for you. If we wanted to bring a complaint towards Family First, then if we don't know which doctor to cite, how do we do that, if that is something that the board wanted to do?
Well, that's where the challenge comes in, Dr. Moffitt, is since we don't license the entities, we would have to send a complaint to a doctor. So if there was a doctor who saw the patient after Dr. Paul did, that would probably be the only way, unless there's a doctor listed as the statutory agent for the business. I don't know if it's optometrist owned or not. I believe Dr. Paul said it was not.
In this case, more appropriate for the patient to bring a complaint against the business entity for failure to maintain? I mean, who has the responsibility, I guess, is what I'm trying to determine.
This is Dr. Cohen. I can state that in a lot of situations like this now, since an optometrist can only be employed by an optometrist or an optometric group, that the separate entities are set up specifically to achieve that. And my understanding is invariably there is one person who acts as the leader or statutory agent of that group. So that should be something that should be available to find out who is in that group and who acts as the lead person of that group.
Dr. Paul, do you know who that person is?
I believe it's Dr. John Womack.
And Dr. Moffitt,
I'm sorry. He is a licensed optometrist in Arizona, and he's the chief medical officer of the doctor's group.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a different leadership for West Point, which runs the optical group. And this is you're asking interesting questions I thought of myself. The manager that approved, let's shred the records, violated both the company policy and our policies. So there were no policies that were actually violated. The manager just made a dumb mistake and said, shred all the boxes in that room.
Certainly.
So no one had a policy to get rid of the records.
The patient's complaint gets addressed at the correct level, right? So that this effect's changed and it doesn't happen again. So I just want to make sure that the right person understands.
Oh, I agree with that 100%.
Yeah.
Madam President, members of the board, you could also open a complaint with the Arizona Corporation Commission. That's where those kind of complaints get for, you know, statutory agents, owners, managers of the various companies when they're registered. That's also an option.
Okay. So should we, so I guess my question now directed to the other board members is, one, do we pursue this further? Two, how do you all see that we should pursue it? Should we direct this towards Dr. John Womack? Should we direct a complaint towards the Arizona Corporation Commission? Should we direct comments towards the patient and ask her to pursue it with the Arizona Corporation Commission? How does the board feel like we should go forward?
This is Dr. Brown. I'm pulling up the complaint. I didn't put a timeline down in my summary. So just a quick review. What year was the exam that's been lost?
So I can tell you she wanted visual fields from 2018 and prior. She was a patient there through 2020. Dr. Paul sold the practice in 2017.
So wow.
She placed the request in 2023. They have a responsibility to maintain the records for 6 years. So 2018, 2017 is really what they're missing. And then also, really, it looks like the patient's complaint that they did not respond in the 5 days. And so there were two areas where the practice did not maintain the records in the fashion that they were expected to.
So sold in 2017, examined 2018. So the records, as you, I think, have pointed out, are actually owned by the group, not by Dr. Paul.
Correct. Dr. Paul is really not responsible. But the owner is.
I think a conversation should at least be held with those that are responsible for the.
I agree. I think that my thoughts are that this complaint should at least get passed on to the right people so that they understand they're responsible for this and failed to meet their requirements of record maintenance.
I agree.
Any other thoughts from the board?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. I agree with that. I think that Dr. Paul should not be held accountable for it because he was not the owner. And particularly, as Dr. Brown just put out about the timing of it, with the records being sought as subsequent to the sale, not even the matter that he was no longer responsible for the records as he wisely put into his sales agreement. The other thing is that I think is important to state, and you mentioned this, Dr. Moffitt, is about the comments that are made and delays that occur. We all have to be careful with staff members to not take it on their own that they have it. And comments like, if indeed it was stated this way, he's very busy, he'll get around to it when he can. And while he hasn't been able to get over there for a patient who has glaucoma and is concerned about the etiology and the timing of it, I think is unprofessional and inappropriate. And I think the very least need to make sure that staff are educated about what things they can answer, what things they need to get more information about, particularly if it puts the doctor at risk for violating one of our statutes. But my view is Dr. Paul, and I think a very well phrased and approached to this response is should not be held responsible. And I do agree that I think we should go further, whether it be Dr. Womack or through the Corporation Commission, to at least get more information and potentially hold those accountable, whether this was done inadvertent or not.
Thank you. Maybe I'll ask for some detail here from Margaret. Margaret, if the board were to file a complaint with the Arizona Corporation Commission, what does that look like? What process is that? Do you know?
Yes, thank you, Madam President. Any member of the public can file a complaint, the board included. So I would just log in on behalf of the board and file a complaint and send over the information with the patient name redacted to let them know that there's a problem with this particular business. And they would do whatever their investigative process is.
Okay. So for my part, I might suggest, and then I'd like to hear from the board members collectively about this, but for my part, I might suggest that the board files a complaint with the Arizona Corporation Commission and that we also send a letter maybe to Dr. Womack just to make him aware of this situation, that the practice failed, in our opinion, in this way to maintain the records correctly, but that we found Dr. Paul was not responsible for this, but to let him know what the deficiencies were in the timing, a timely response in the request of the patient's records and a failure to produce the records that were requested. I think that might be appropriate made aware of at the least. Those are my thoughts.
I second that motion. I know it wasn't a motion, but I still second it.
All right.
Yeah. Before you do that, Madam President, I would prefer if you would have a motion and a vote just for Dr. Paul's case, okay. So whether the board is going to dismiss. Sure. Just do that, and then you can direct staff to do whatever you want after that.
Okay. So I just want to make sure that all the board members are in agreement. I haven't heard from Dr. Mastoris regarding dismissal of Dr. Paul's case, or from Dr. Carpenter, or from Mr. Hamid. I'd like your thoughts on that.
This is Dr. Carpenter. Yeah, this is Dr. Carpenter. I agree with the discussion. Yeah, what's said.
Okay. Dr. Mastoris, I heard your comments. Mr. Hamid, any thoughts here?
I agree as well. I second the comments that were just made.
Okay. Then I would make a motion that we dismiss the complaint against Dr. Paul as there's no violation of the Optometric Practice Act.
Dr. Brown, I second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, so we've had a motion and a second to dismiss the complaint against Dr. Paul. Let's vote. Mr. Hamid, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastoris?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. And then just in follow-up regarding this complaint, I would like to make a motion that we file a complaint with the Arizona Corporation Commission regarding failure to maintain records and respond in a timely manner with regard to this Pearle Vision location that Dr. Paul works at. And that also we would send a letter to Dr. John Womack, letting him know our concerns with regard to this case and this location. That's my motion.
There, Dr. Brown, I second.
Thank you.
Marguerite.
Go ahead.
Yes, Marguerite Baskin. Yes. As far as sending a letter to the other doctor, we haven't given them any notice of this. I believe that the board's options would be to open a complaint and then let him respond and let him appear rather than sending a letter regarding that.
What if we sent him a copy of the complaint?
I think that no, I think he would need to open a complaint. Yes.
Okay. So we're still in open discussion then before we vote.
Madam President, members of the board, yes. Madam President, you could revise that instead of just saying sending a letter to Dr. Womack, you could just move to open a complaint as Ms. Baskin had advised. It's same process as it was for Dr. Paul. The complaint would then go to Dr. Womack and he would respond on his position of regarding the record keeping.
Yes. Thank you, Margaret. This is Mona Baskin. Yes. The board has the authority to make an motion complaint against licensees, and that would be the appropriate method to address this issue. Sending a conclusory letter with the board's concerns without his input would not be the preferred way to go.
Can I amend my complaint then at this stage, or do we have to vote on this and then remove?
May I ask a question first, if you don't mind, Dr. Cohen? Should we give any consideration if it turns out that it's more the Corporation Commission because of this entity versus Dr. Womack as the chief medical officer, the fact that we're about to have listed under his permanent record that a complaint was filed against him, if we have question as to whether the main purpose, as you were saying, Dr. Moffitt, was for him to be informed of what we're doing. But once a complaint is filed, if someone goes and researches it in the future, they'll at least see there was a complaint filed against this doctor. I just want to make sure we're not insensitive to the fact that this goes on his record.
I guess for my part in answering that question, I would say that I'm fine giving him, it's just an opportunity. As far as I'm concerned, a complaint doesn't necessarily mean the doctor did something wrong. So it's not a judgment against him, but it's an opportunity for him to at least be made aware and to address this concern. And the board will make a decision after that, whether he's responsible or not. So that's my thought on it. Others on the board?
Dr. Moffitt, members of the board, this is Mona Baskin. Regarding the Corporation Commission, I am a little unclear of the direction that the board would be going regarding this. Is there some irregularity that you're seeing regarding filings at the Corporation Commission, or is this based solely upon the content of the board's concerns regarding record-keeping practice?
I can't hear you super well, Mona, but for my part in answering that question, this is about a concern how this business entity handled the responsibility of maintaining the records.
Madam President,
yes,
if I may, Ms. Baskin, I think the board's intent is to just refer the complaint as we would to the AG's office, to the ombudsman, to the governor's office. They just want to refer the complaint to the Corporation Commission to allow them to investigate the situation for the statutory agent who didn't do their job, possibly. Anytime, you know, the public is aggrieved by something that a corporation does or a contractor, they can file a complaint.
I think it's appropriate to
that would be an option.
Madam President, Sammy Hamid.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mr. Hamid.
Thank you. I'm going to make another suggestion here. I'll even make a motion, actually, as I think.
We have an open motion right now, so we can't. Right?
We're actually, yes, I can make a substitute motion. Yes, I can, actually, under the rules. But I'm going to make a discussion point here first, actually. I think we can get around this. We've obviously dismissed the complaint, obviously, against Dr. Paul. What we could do is tell the complaint, if they feel otherwise, they can file a complaint directly with the Corporation Commission. And also, of that being said, Ms. Baskin, a legal question for you here. Are we overstepping if we step out and try to make the attempt to file a complaint with the Corporation Commission? Are we going beyond our boundaries as a board?
Well, you have two options. You can go into a executive session. We can discuss this more. I could just say generally, this is just generally what the board does is deal with their, you know, licensees and individuals that we regulate to discuss these matters. But Ms. Whalen is also correct that we make criminal referrals. I've just never had a board refer to the Corporation Commission in my experience. So I don't know what their investigative parameters are. I think they would be limited to whatever is in their statutes. But I know that other boards have, you know, referred things to the Department of Insurance, which I guess would be, you know, similar in this situation. So that would be the option. What I think that the focus is what is the board's, what is your intent? Are you intending to alert licensees of their obligation regarding record keeping? Yes, we dismissed the case against Dr. Paul and he, you know, came and presented quite, you know, in detail regarding the process, but I guess it would depend on what the intent is.
This is Dr. Cohen, I have a question for Ms. Baskin.
I hope that's helpful.
This is Dr. Cohen, I have a question for Ms. Baskin. Besides the in its title, as it stated, is SonoX as statutory agent for an entity then responsible directly for making sure the statutes are followed?
No, I do not have an answer for you on that, Dr. Cohen, as far as what the, you know, I would have to research that and I would have to come back and let you all know. I do know that your licensees are the ones that have that professional responsibility under your statute that this board has, you know, that your function is to regulate the profession. Now, whether that extends to a statutory agent, I do not know. And I would need additional time.
But my question being, because in this case, Dr. Womack is apparently acting as the chief medical officer. I don't know if that is a pseudonym in this case to statutory agents that he takes on as an optometrist license in Arizona, the responsibility for actions that occur within that entity, separate from the corporation commission. I'm talking specifically as the optometrist who is the lead of this group.
Right. And that would be your link to the board's concern regarding a licensee's understanding implementation of record keeping and responding to records requests. So that would be very appropriate should the board which could go in that direction to open up a complaint against that individual because yes, Dr. Cohen, in their capacity as a leader within as far as their obligation to run the business and to be aware of that. So I think that would be very appropriate. And they are functioning in that administrative role, but also as a licensee to ensure that within that business, they are following the statutes and rules of this board.
Thank you, Ms. Baskin. Then Dr. Moffitt, might it be appropriate to pivot and to reverse what you're saying and saying that if Dr. Womack is indeed the statutory agent responsible for making sure these things happen, that we bring the complaint to him with then possibly then copying or including the Corporation Commission to make them aware of it rather than the opposite?
I suppose we could. I don't know if that carries the same weight filing a complaint with the Arizona Corporation versus just making them aware of the situation. I don't know. Margaret, do you have any thoughts about that?
Or both.
I do. Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. I think we're losing a little bit of focus here on this discussion from the standpoint of optometrists in this state are independent contractors, which means optometrists are responsible for every aspect of their office, whether they work in a corporate setting, a private practice, they have an office manager. We have these same discussions when it comes to billing. The doctor will say, oh, I don't know, I don't do the billing. It doesn't really matter. The responsibility is the licensees to at least oversee or manage or be aware of things that are going on in their office. So that being said, I do agree with Dr. Moffitt's motion. I feel like if the board has some reservation about, immediately contacting the Corporation Commission, the first and best thing to do would be to open a complaint against a licensee, because if Dr. Womack is indeed the proprietor, manager, whatever word you want to use, he's still the independent contractor optometrist at this practice. So if the burden of the record keeping falls to him, for all the optometrists, that's the agreement, then he would be the person to hit up. I mean, the worst case scenario, Dr. Cohen, I know you were concerned if Dr. Womack is not, if he comes back and says, well, I don't do the records, that's not my responsibility, let me go to the Corporation Commission, because if nobody's claiming it, there's kind of a bigger problem.
I agree with those comments, Margaret. Also, I think that if we bring a complaint against Dr. Womack and then he says, I'm not responsible, but then he knows whose job it is, then at least we're getting closer to the problem. But sometimes, I guess in my opinion, when you're in a larger entity like this, nobody knows who's responsible. So the patient doesn't know who's responsible. How is she supposed to find the responsible party for these records? And how do we affect change here? So it's not supposed to go like this when you request records. They're supposed to be made available to you. They're supposed to be stored. The entity is responsible for this, and I believe we should pursue it. So maybe at this point I'll amend my motion and I'll say that for the time being, I believe that what the board should do, I would move that we would file a complaint against Dr. John Womack for failure to maintain records and respond to a records request in a timely manner. And we can pursue it further from there once we find out what Dr. Womack says. So that would be my motion. Is there a second?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I would second that.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. Any further discussion?
Yes, just one quick question. Should it in the complaint state that the complaint's being made with him as the acting statutory agent of the Arizona entity? Does that need to be specified?
No.
No? Okay.
Not at this time, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? All right, so let's vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Abstain.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 5. And then do I count the abstention?
Who abstained?
He abstained. Mr. Hamed.
Mr. Hamed, you can abstain. You participated in the discussion. You have to vote no or yes, please.
I'll vote no.
Thank you.
Motion passes 5-1.
Excellent discussion. Thank you. Madam Chair, I don't know who the 805 phone number is, if that's a patient or a licensee here for one of the complaints.
Yeah, I see two numbers. I don't know who they are, but hopefully they just speak up if they want to. So we'll move forward to agenda item F3, Dr. Preston Summerhays, IR. Actually, should we move forward to someone else who we know is present?
Yes, either number 6, number 7.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll move forward just so our other attendees aren't waiting longer. We'll move forward to agenda item F6, Dr. Jason Klepfix, IR number 202415. Dr. Klepfix, I see that you are present. Is patient AR present? Okay, and is counsel present for Dr. Klepfix?
No, just myself.
Okay, am I pronouncing your name correctly, Klepfix?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so can I have a board summary, please, then, regarding IR 202415?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I can offer a board summary.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter.
Patient AR presented to the office on, I believe it was the 8th of January of this year, and went in for a routine eye exam. But at that point, it was, it was explained to her that she had a medical condition on one of the corneas and that they were going to change this into a medical visit, take care of the present issue. And then she could come back another time to finish up the exam. And at that time prescribe the new contacts and whatnot. So she came back on the 17th, to finish the exam. And at which point the exam was completed. And so at that point, the exam and the optos were billed through her VSP, whereas the visit on the 8th became a medical visit and was billed to Cigna. The concern of the patient, AR, is that she was being double billed and double charged. She didn't understand the difference between the two visits and felt like she was being double billed for the OptiMap as well as just the exam, and had some concerns about potential insurance fraud with the timeline. For Dr. Klepfit's part, I think he explained very well the process and the reason for changing that first exam over to a medical, and then the subsequent exam to be the vision exam through her vision insurance, and explained that there was not any double billing done to the patient or to the insurance, but that she was charged and that the insurances were billed appropriately. I know one of her concerns was she was trying to get proof from Cigna that they had been billed, just trying to make sure that things were being handled correctly. But Dr. Klepfis explained that they were billed with a paper claim. It'll take some time before that EOB is generated. That's our summary.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. Dr. Klepfis, would you like to respond?
I agree with Dr. Carpenter. All this was explained to the patient during the exam, as well as Exhibit 1 that I submitted, the Weave chat, that shows the patient was once again explained exactly how everything was billed, why it was billed that way, and responded in agreement with it prior to filing this complaint.
Okay, does that conclude your comments?
Yes.
Thank you. So this will conclude open discussion and we'll discuss it amongst the board members. Comments from the board?
Madam President, I'm sorry for the record. I would just like to note that Dr. Stephanie Mastoris has stepped away due to conflict on this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question for Dr. Klepfitz. So I understand, obviously, the billing for the medical concern separately of the vision exam. Unfortunately, you submitted records, and the only date of service is for the 17th. So there doesn't appear to be an exam from January the 8th.
I did a comprehensive on the 8th, and that should have been submitted. I'm looking at what I submitted, and it's showing that I submitted an exam for the 8th.
It shows you submitted it, but you didn't submit records from the 8th for the exam. So, of course, if we're looking for two different dates of service and you've billed for two different dates of service, I don't understand why we only have an exam from the 17th.
I see what happened. That was just a labeling issue on my part. I can submit the exam for the 8th as well. I was relabeling everything for submittal, and I just relabeled the exam for the 17th as the 8th by accident. There was a comprehensive exam on the 8th.
Okay, because, so number one, I don't understand the labeling comment that you just made there. Your exam should be dated, and it shouldn't ever be changed, right?
It is dated and not changed. It is labeled for submittal, so you guys were aware of what exhibit it was.
So I think that that would be a really good thing to have, because otherwise the implication is that this is all one date of service, and then that actually supports what the patient is claiming, is that there were not two separate office visits made. Comments from the board members? Would we want to maybe delay this complaint and give Dr. Klepfitz an opportunity to submit for the records? I will say that we do ask you for all the records, of course, when we send you notice of the complaint. Thoughts from other board members?
Yes, I have a question for the doctor. You just stated that that a comprehensive exam was done on the 8th.
She was brought in for her annual wellness visit. On the way back to the exam lane, she is auto-refracted, optosis performed, and we started the exam as a comprehensive. Once we reached the point post-refraction of evaluating her corneas, she was deemed to have PEK and a complaint of corneal irritation. So it was decided at that point, discussed with the patient, that we should treat the cornea, treat the SPK, and then have her come back in a week, and we'll finish the comprehensive exam as well as fit her for contact lenses.
Thank you.
Dr. Brown, thoughts?
I'm not against tabling this and asking for the complete record.
Okay.
So this is Dr. Carpenter. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I have no problem with what was done and the procedure, but it is true there should be a separate exam record for the 8th, so that explains everything. So if it's just a matter of submitting that so that we have the full picture, then that would be good to do.
Mr. Hamed, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think a delay is appropriate in order to get the response needed, actually, so I would support that.
Would someone like to make a motion?
Go ahead, Dr. Brown. I move that we table the topic until we have further records submitted.
And this is Dr. Cohn, I'll second that.
Any further discussion? Okay. So we've had a motion to table this complaint until a future meeting date so that Dr. Klepfitz can submit all of the records. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 5-0. Thank you, Dr. Plepsitz.
Thank you.
We'll move forward to agenda item F7, Dr. Daniel Valdez. IR number 202416. Is patient CG present? Counsel for Dr. Valdez present?
Just myself.
No. Dr. Valdez, I see you there. Okay. So can I have a board summary for IR number 202416?
Madam President, yes. Excuse me, I would just like the record to reflect Dr. Mastores has rejoined the meeting.
Okay.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Mastores. I can do the summary.
Thank you.
So this is IR number 202416, Dr. Valdez, patient CG. The exam was done on October 16, 2023. The patient wears RGB multifocals, I believe. And she was charged for a specialty contact lens fit. And she feels that she was overcharged for her contact lens exam on her vision plan. She feels that she should have paid the standard fitting fee, which was significantly less. I believe a refund was issued to the patient, and the patient was dismissed from the practice. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Valdez, would you like to take a moment and address the board? And am I saying your name correctly? Is it Valdez?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
When we got to the point in the exam where, we discussed the contact lens fitting, she was presented with a sheet, which is my exhibit 2, explaining basically the cost of the exam and what her benefits covered. Otherwise, everything was followed to the T as far as charging her for, the correct amount for that type of fitting for contact lens. And, as I explained, in my response, we did submit the, we did charge the proper amount and submitted it to her IMED insurance. However, in submitting the claim, our billing specialist basically clicked a standard fitting fee instead of the premium fitting fee, which created the discrepancy in the EOB, and that's where the situation arose. But we did, honor our mistake and refunded her the difference or the amount that was stated on her EOB. So, the matter was pretty much resolved.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Valdez. Does that conclude your comments?
As far as dismissing her from the practice, I have not done so. There is a proper way of dismissal. I was having a conversation with Margaret the other day. I am licensed in the state of Florida in Virginia, and our statutes in Florida do cite a correct way to dismiss a patient, and that has not been done, so she's not been dismissed from the practice. If she is dismissed from the practice, I did respond briefly. It'll be done so, appropriately and accordingly, so that, the patient is not abandoned or left out, to her own devices, basically.
Dr. Valdez, I wanted to ask you, did she pay for her contacts, the actual contacts themselves?
I believe she did.
Okay. I just know that they're expensive contacts, so.
Yeah. I mean, she paid what, and she paid whatever her insurance, benefits didn't cover, whatever the
difference.
Thank
you. Sure. Okay. This will conclude open discussion, and I'll open this up. I did that already. Well, I didn't really. I'll open it up now for board discussion. Okay. Further comments from the board?
This is Dr. Carpenter. Just looking through this, I do feel like everything's above board. She knew exactly what she was committing to. The problem arose when it was billed under the wrong category, And so she gets her EOB back saying basically that she was overcharged. And so then she had that in her head that hey, she should be getting some money back. And so I think the practice did the right thing of just reimbursing the money. They could have just rebilled it and provided her with the correct EOB showing the correct form, the correct amounts that she had committed already, but they went ahead and just reimbursed that. So I don't see any violation of the Practice Act.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. I'll also say, Dr. Valdez, from my review, I thought you did an excellent job. I thought this was really unfortunate that the patient misunderstood, I guess, maybe what happened and persisted in receiving this refund and then also filed a complaint against you. It doesn't in any way look like it's fair, I guess, in the world of fair out there. But I wanted to at least say that for your benefit, your records reflect you did a very good job. This doesn't reflect on you in any way. And I think it's an unfortunate turn of events.
That was my take on it. Thank you.
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. I want to actually build off of what Dr. Malkin just said. One of the things Dr. Valdez and speaking practitioner more now, I was really quite moved by your statement in there about your reputation and your aspiration to practice and everything stated with that. And just as a thought process, when a legitimate error was made like this in creating goodwill, which may then retain this patient, to consider the fact you ultimately gave the refund and that if you had done so perhaps at the beginning, when it occurred, said, look, sort of like Monopoly Bank error in your favor, not only would the patient have been appreciative and been aware that next year there would be a different fee, but you'd also would have reduced the likelihood of a complaint going before the state board and any social media reviews or anything else the patient may have done. So in light of your very noble aspiration of how you want to practice, consider, is it worth the $117.50 to create ill will and rather than to look at it as an investment in building goodwill with your patients and to have the kind of practice you clearly aspire to have.
Thank you. Absolutely. I could just add one quick thing. Maybe it's not so relevant, but fortunately, in the state of Florida, part of our continuing education requirements involved two credit hours in jurisprudence and two credit hours in medical errors every biennium. And what's ironic about this situation is, now being licensed there in Florida for 12 bienniums, I have about, about 50 hours of jurisprudence and medical errors under my belt. And one of the things that is repeatedly brought up and discussed in those courses is when somebody wants their money back, give it to them and let them go. Because otherwise, I'm sitting here with you guys in the situation that I've heard repeatedly in the classroom in continuing education for the exact reasons that, that have been stated. So anyways, that's all I got. I think it would be beneficial if in the state of Arizona we had some kind of requirement like that. And I guess that's my point.
It's a gracious way to look at it, Dr. Valdez. It's really hard, I'll say, on the practitioner's part when you do something as complicated as a RGP multifocal fit and then have the patient request a very significant amount of the feedback when this is not something that is really much of a money maker in a practice. It's more of a service you do for your patient, trying to help them see and oftentimes take a loss doing or really, like I said, very marginal benefit to the doctor. A lot of work, not a lot of pay for it. And so I understand any, hesitancy to just really say, okay, yeah, I overcharged. Yeah, here's your money. Yeah. So it's hard for all of us to do. It's very complicated. It's not understood well, I think. And I'll say for the record, it looked like you did an excellent job. I don't feel like this reflects on you. We all run into difficulty from time to time. It's a little bit outside of our control and try to handle it the best we can. And hopefully we all learn from this and just move forward. So
sure.
Those are my thoughts on it.
Thank you.
Other thoughts from the board? Dr. Carpenter, you haven't said anything? No thoughts? Dr. Brown?
I'm a little disappointed the patient isn't here. I was a little disturbed that through a patient's misunderstanding that he could be reported to the board, reported to the Better Business Bureau, and then be surprised that he doesn't want her back in the office. So kudos to him for doing everything he can and keeping within the law, and I don't find any violation of the Optometric Act. I move we dismiss this.
Thank you. I second. Further discussion? Okay, so we've had a motion and a second to dismiss the case against Dr. Valdez. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Thank you for your attendance, Dr. Valdez.
Thank you, everyone.
So we'll move forward to agenda item F3, Preston Summerhays, Dr. Summerhays, excuse me, IR number 202412. Is patient MC present or is it MG? I think it's MG. Can't read my own handwriting today, Dr. Cohen. counsel for Dr. Summerhays? And is Dr. Summerhays present? Okay. Can I have a board summary?
This is Dr. Brown. Patient presented and thought that she had declined both the Optomap and dilation. At the conclusion of the exam, she was informed that she needed to be dilated. She was then dilated and has since complained that that she would have preferred to have rescheduled. Dr. Summerhays has replied, stating that's their office policy. And in one of his defenses, he did state that it was a possibility for her to reschedule. That's the end of my summary.
Okay, thank you. As neither the patient or respondent are here, I'll open this up for board discussion. Comments from the board?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. One of the things I felt to see there might be a violation of the policy, or particularly since Dr. Summerhays included the office form that's used that says that crosses out optos at as an alternative and underneath is dilation or dilate signed by the patient. So there was informed consent, but I wish Dr. Summerhays was here because I was a bit bothered by a couple of his comments that if the patient wasn't comfortable or was uncomfortable, the patient shouldn't have driven a car. And I think that one thing needs to be clear is the difference between informed consent and implied consent. Implied consent is that the patient may have light sensitivity but should be capable of driving a car, and if not, should not have, versus informed consent to clearly state, if we go ahead and dilate, be aware it could impact your ability even if you're driving 2 miles away. And I felt that it was a bit flippant in the way that was handled. But having said that, I don't see a violation because the patient was given a form and signed the form that explained what procedure was going to be done if it wasn't going to be the optos that the patient opted for the prior visit.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Other comments?
Dr. Brown here. I share some of those same concerns, and I'm very concerned about the form itself. It just says optos on it. Then it has to be scratched out and written in instead of selected. I think that it would be wise to have the patient initial there if they're going to make that change. It also does not offer on that selection page for a rescheduling. I think I wanted to talk to Dr. Summerhays today and ask if that indeed is an option in his office. The patient seemed to feel that it wasn't. He also stated that she was okay to drive. Let me just, in his response, which I wanted to know the objective test he used to determine that. And number four, dilation does not impede the patient from driving. So there, I agree with some of the concerns in his response. I would really like to talk to Dr. Summerhays about this, but I would like to talk to Dr. Summerhays.
This is Dr. Masvars. I see a retina specialist. I had to go to Peoria once and I was dilated and I had to drive home and it was terrible. And so I drove home. I drove to my in-law's house because I couldn't drive. So I sympathize with the patient. But it was standard of care the way that the exam went down. So it's, I'm conflicted here.
Dr.
Moffitt, if I might ask for discussion purposes, I don't know that we're going to find any potential violation of statute, but are we within our purview to do like Dr. Brown had said about including a concern about the way the form is as far as initialing that and something about being in there about what the option of rescheduling is? Can we express any concern or recommendation based upon the way the forms work? Or is that outside our purview?
Margaret.
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. So there's a couple options here. Based on the discussion, the board can table it and direct staff to strongly encourage Dr. Summerhays' attendance. It always is, but I can certainly reach back out to him. The second option would be the board can move it to informal interview. The doctor would be more strongly encouraged in writing. It would be an official notice, a 30-day requirement, and the board could still have the same discussion and dismiss at that time, but it's a little more formal process, despite the name. The other option is to send a letter of concern. With all of these concerns, the doctor chose not to appear. The board has concerns. While you would like to hear from the doctor, if you felt like you can make a decision without him, you could certainly issue a letter of concern at this time as well. So three different things to think about for you.
For purposes of the discussion, I'll give my thoughts. I think that Dr. Brown and Dr. Cohen have both brought up good points and have made constructive comments. I don't see that Dr. Summerhays violated any statutes. In fact, he did perform standard of care. And so the conversation with driving, I'll say this comes up with us frequently. And I usually advise my patient, it sounds something like this, yes, you can drive after you've been dilated. It can depend a little bit on the strength of dilating drops, right? We all know that. Dr. Mastoris, you may have had, a 1% and 2.5% concentration. You might have had a 10% concentration at the retina doctor's office, as our retina doctor's offices do here. So, that can be a little bit more intense than the typical. I do a 1% tropicamide dilation in my office. I frequently tell the patient, they ask if they can drive, and I say, yes, you can drive. I drive home from the retina doctor's office. I drive 40 minutes, actually, home after my appointment at retina. But it can depend very much on the person, right? This can be sort of an individual comfort level about how you feel after you're dilated. And most people, unless it's their very first eye exam, I've had this done before. This patient was a high myope. I just think there's probably arguments to be made on both sides of this situation. But as far as I'm concerned, Dr. Summerhays did his job. That's what it looks like to me. He did his job. He dilated the patient and he offered her an alternative. She elected not to do that. She was advised before the drops went in that these were dilating drops. She could have said, hold up, hold right now. I really, really want to, reschedule. So I don't know. Nobody likes to be dilated. And so there's oftentimes this avoidance of it, but it's in the patient's best interest. And so I'm more inclined to look at this position of Dr. Summerhays that he's doing what's in the patient's best interest as opposed to trying to make her life difficult, I guess. That's my take on it. But I'll say again, I think you both brought up constructive comments. I think the form would be great. It probably should say either or, right? And that would be much more clear. So those are my thoughts.
I appreciate those thoughts, Dr. Moffitt. I just want to say that I found it unclear as to whether the option to reschedule was presented or considered. That's the only thing. Obviously, standard of care is being held. They're addressing those But if that's not being presented or offered or denied, then there would be a concern. So that's why I wanted this. And I'm fine moving forward without, but I was hoping to be able to question Dr. Summerhays on that and their office's practices, because patient consent and their schedule that day, she had to take some time off work to recover. A lot of my patients will reschedule for end of day on a different week that's more convenient. So I think that being able to make that option needs to be a possibility. And that was unclear to me in both responses.
Yeah. I think sensitivity. I think if I'm reading both you and Dr. Cohen correctly, it's that Dr. Summerhays looked a little insensitive to this issue. So that's my take. Dr. Carpenter, any comments?
Well, I certainly agree with everything that's been said. I noticed the same things. You know, we've raised concern many times in the past over patients not being dilated. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, nobody wants to be dilated. And so oftentimes we err on the other side of that where we, so I don't think we should hold his feet to the fire because he did follow the standard of care. But yes, I also agree. That was a thought of mine on the form. Could it just simply say, I choose to be dilated or I choose to reschedule to dilate? And, as Dr. Brown brought up, you know, Dr. Summerhays' responses do seem pretty matter of fact and unsensitive to the situation. So we just want to make sure that the patient did understand that they could reschedule for the procedure. Her perspective was she just wasn't even given that opportunity. But without Dr. Summerhays here, we really don't know. We can't really ask about that. I don't think we need to bring him back and have another discussion with him present. Like Dr. Cohen brought up earlier, what are we able to do? Could we do a letter of concern just saying maybe just look at this? But I don't want to escalate it to anything more than we have to. So I'm not even convinced we need to do that. But like, do we automatically give them a letter that just says, hey, this was reviewed, it was dismissed, there were no violations, but the board did say, hey, you might just make sure your patients understand that they do have the option to reschedule, something like that.
Madam President, members of the board, Dr. Carpenter, the dismissal letter does say where the recording is, and I always provide the time at which that particular complaint was reviewed so the doctor can go straight to that and listen to the board proceedings, if that's helpful at all.
And Dr. Moffitt, Dr. Carpenter, members of the board, I just want to read you the legal definition of ARS 32-17-44 of what this board, Section E, needs to find to issue a letter of concern. And it states, if the board determines that a reasonable basis exists to believe that a violation of this chapter or rules adopted pursuant to this chapter has occurred, I hope you can hear me, and the violation is not sufficiently serious to warrant discipline, it may send a letter of concern to advise them of a possible violation. So the board would have to find that the doctor has a possible violation of the statutes and rules. So it sounds like maybe the dismissal letter with the language contained that Margaret mentioned may be more in line with what the board is discussing.
I agree. Yeah, this is Dr. Carpenter again. Yeah, so in light of that definition, I think that a letter of concern would not be warranted because there's nothing here that insinuates any type or suspicion of violation.
I'm in agreement with you, Dr. Carpenter. Dr. Mansour? I'm sorry if I cut anybody off. Go ahead, Dr. Brown.
I agree as well. Okay. I agree
Dr. with Dr. Mansour, I agree.
Dr. Cohen?
Yes, I agree that there's a letter of concern is not appropriate here. And I hope that maybe that he will take up the opportunity to listen to this discussion.
Mr. Hamed, any comments?
No, I agree with everything that's been said. Actually, I think we should move to dismiss this without further delay.
Okay. Would anyone like to make a motion?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I move that we dismiss this case, that there have been no violations of the Optometric Practice Act.
This is Dr. Cohen. I second it.
Thank you. So we have a motion and a second to dismiss the complaint against Dr. Summerhays. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Complaint F4, Tanya Lewis-Polek, IR number 202413. Is patient JM present? Counsel for Dr. Lewis-Polek? No. And Dr. Lewis-Polek present? No. Okay, can I have a board summary regarding this complaint? I could also summarize. I'll do this one. All right. So patient JM saw Dr. Lewis-Polek in February 2023 for an evaluation for dizziness. Patient obtained a glasses prescription that he was unable to adjust to. He returned for a recheck and obtained a different prescription, but was also unable to adjust. He felt he was told he needed to adjust and couldn't. I believe he felt like the office was insensitive to his concern. He felt he was told he needed to, he saw Dr. Sannon in Tucson and received an alternate prescription and adjusted to that. He also saw Dr. Bixman, and it looked like from the records, the visit with Dr. Bixman, who's a neuro-ophthalmologist in Tucson, was just prior to the visit with Dr. Sannon. Dr. Bixman found on his evaluation a left inferior homonymous hemianopia, or a visual field defect by confrontation visual fields, though. At that visit, he didn't follow it with any kind of threshold visual field testing or imaging after that. CT imaging prior to that date had been done, I think it was in 2018, but there was no findings, no stroke findings, nothing, just age-related changes. A Goldman visual field was done in Dr. Polek's office, and that did not show a inferior homonymous hemianopia. So these two visual field results conflicted with one another. The CT scan was from 2021. Patient requested a copy of that visual field, but I think didn't recognize it because the form of the Goldman is so different from the confrontation field display that Dr. Bixman's records showed. Patient JM asked for an $1,800 refund from Dr. Polek's office, and I believe also received the $1,800 refund. Or he asked for a refund. He was given an $1,800 refund. Okay, that concludes my summary. Further comments or comments from the board now? All right. Dr. Carpenter, thoughts?
Yes, this is Dr. Carpenter. You know, as I went through this, kind of a complicated case with a lot of things going on, but I think ultimately as we know, we've got a patient here who has had a stroke, has some balance and vertigo issues, which with age, it can make that subjective refraction a little bit more difficult to obtain. And we've all been there where, there can be some variability for whatever reason, just having a hard time getting that nailed down and feeling comfortable. I don't know if the patient understands the difference between plus cylinder and minus cylinder. That can make the two prescriptions that were prescribed radically different, just at a glance to a patient. But I don't see any violations. I thought the care was very thorough. I just think it was a matter of not being able to adapt to the glasses, and maybe the patient not feeling like their concern was being heard, or not having enough access to the doctor to try to make it right.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter.
This is Dr. Mastores. Dr. Carpenter, that was very well said, and I agree with what you said.
I'll also put my two cents in there. When I looked at everything, I saw no violation of the Optometric Practice Act. As best I can tell, so same patients see prescriptions written in plus cylinder form, and they see it written in minus cylinder form, and they don't understand that these are sort of translated from one another, so they look very different, but they are not necessarily different. I put all of those prescriptions in minus cylinder form and compared them. And, Dr. Pollack's prescription had a little more plus on the left eye and a little more cylinder. Dr. Bixman's had some plus and some cylinder. Dr. Sannon's had less. And so I'm sure that's what he was having trouble adjusting to. It does not in any way imply that it was incorrect, though, that prescription had more than the other. So I saw absolutely no issue there and would say that to the patient if he were here and in attendance. I'll also say that if he's having dizziness issues and he wants a remedy and he's having trouble finding remedy for that, that's a common problem and hard for anybody to solve. And so I understand the patient's frustration. When he saw Dr. Bixman and he said, well, you've had a stroke. I mean, I looked at the records. That's what he said. You've had a stroke. He did it based on a confrontation visual field. I think the world of Dr. Bixman, but if I diagnosed a stroke based on a confrontation visual field, I would probably never hear the end of that. To not have followed up with a threshold visual field or a CT scan that confirms evidence of a stroke, most of the other providers would laugh us right out of the room. And so, like I said, I think the world of him, but you can't just say that to a patient, you've had a stroke and that's the end of it. It implies that the other doctor who didn't see evidence of a stroke is wrong, but there's really no basis here. We don't know. We don't know is the takeaway. So I understand why the patient would be confused by that and upset by that, but there's no medical evidence other than, like I said, a confrontation field, which is very gross way to measure that kind of thing and would never really stand up under any kind of scrutiny. So those were my thoughts. I don't think Dr. Pollack did anything wrong, and I'm sorry for the patient's frustration in this case, but I see no violation of the Optometric Practice Act. I would like to get the other doctors on the record, though. Dr. Brown, any comments?
I agree with everything that's been said. I see no violation.
Dr. Cohen?
I agree as well.
Mr. Hamed, any comments?
No comment.
Okay, would anyone like to offer a motion?
Dr. Brown, I move that we dismiss the complaint because we find no violation of the Optometric Practice Act.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Dr. Mastores, I'll second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? So we've had a motion and a second to dismiss the complaint against Dr. Lewis Pollack. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Our final complaint for the day, agenda item F5, Dr. Patrick Colrick. IR number 202414. Is patient EF present? No. Counsel for Dr. Colrick present?
I am not counsel. I am the CEO of the practice and happy to comment if asked, but no counsel.
Okay. Thank you. And is Dr. Colrick present? Okay. Could I have a board summary in Dr. Colrick's complaint?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I'm happy to summarize.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter.
So the patient EF presented for an eye exam. Let's see, I believe that was December 29th, 23. And at that time, opted to, so they, apparently there's a charge for the refraction that's separate of $55. And they were told during the exam that there had been little to no change in the prescription, and so they opted to not pay that amount. But then the patient went back to the office a few days later requesting a copy of their prescriptions, and they were told that they could receive those, but they would need to pay $50 in order to be able to receive that, at which case the patient became very upset, and the patient admittedly used some very colorful language, and of course this was documented as well by the staff. They felt somewhat threatened, and but ultimately the patient did pay, if I remember right, the patient did pay the amount, and they were given the prescriptions, but then as they were leaving continued to shout some obscenities. So then the complaint was raised about having to pay extra just to be able to get their prescription.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. So as the respondent is not present and the patient are not present, I'll open this up for board discussion next.
Actually, I just joined the meeting.
Oh, this is okay.
Dr. Kohlrick.
Great. So Dr. Kohlrick, if you'd like to address the board, this is your opportunity to do so.
Yeah, so I guess we'd seen this person a year previously and doesn't have any medical or vision coverage. So we did a kind of a comprehensive exam and then gave him prescriptions from the previous.
You cut out, Dr. Kohlrick. We can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yep, we hear you now.
Okay. So basically, he came in this year on, I think it was the 29th, I think Dr. Carpenter mentioned, for a routine eye exam. He doesn't have any types of insurance. And generally, the practice charges $55 for a refraction and contact lens prescription. So he signed to get that day. But when he was leaving the exam room, he said, "Did I have any changes in my vision?" And both my scribe assistant and myself mentioned that he did not have any changes. And he said, "Well, then I don't, you know," he elected not to pay the $55 contact lens service and refraction service, which he had signed, and it's in the paperwork. So, and then what often happens is that's the case. We don't know if it's a person that has like a year's worth of contacts and doesn't need to buy any contacts, but I imagine he probably through another source tried to order some contacts. So he came in a few days later, and I'm not sure why this front desk, it's a $55 fee, and that's what he agreed to pay the day he was seen for the prescription and contact lenses. But for some reason, I think in the heat of the discussion, it was fairly volatile. The staff got, I think, intimidated and said, "Pay me $50 for your fraction." And the gentleman, EF, and his significant other, or whoever's with him, were kind of screaming obscenities and pointing their finger directly at the staff. And I wasn't present. I heard about it, I think, maybe later in the day when he had already left, because I was in the office across the hall. And I guess in normal situations on this, I mean, if a person is unhappy with something, I would rather retain the patient, and I would not charge him for that fee. But I think, unfortunately, in his situation, he had to pay for his eye exam from the previous year also, which he hadn't paid the complete eye exam as of yet, and it was in collection. So I'm sure it was just a very financial stress for him to have to pay for two eye exams and the refraction fee. And the gentleman and I had a very amicable discussion during his exam. The gentleman isn't in town very often. He's a truck driver, and so he isn't in town very often. So you have to make special, you know, arrangements for him to get his eyes examined. So I guess in the heat of the battle, obviously, it was very upsetting to the front desk staff, and they were intimidated. And I think the paperwork that kind of it was explained, our front desk staff are required to, if they have any types of incidences like this, to make a kind of a statement of what happened and put it in the chart. And when we did that, but one of his other frustrations was at that immediate moment, he says, I want my chart right now. And the staff is obviously, the staff that's running the front desk isn't a person that can just print up all the EMR electronic medical records and get it to him at that moment. That requires a few days to get that put together and get that to him. And certainly I would agree that, there was a frustration in this gentleman's part, and he displayed it in his activity that day. I wish I could have retained him, obviously, but I don't feel that we did anything out of the, you know, optometry rules and regulations that would. But this is a frustration, and I still feel bad. And unfortunately, we won't retain the patient, you know, after someone gets belligerent with our front desk office management and I make that decision whether to release the patient from practice. We give them 30 days to be seen at our office for any emergencies and 30 days to acquire some other practice that we could send records to. So we had sent him a notice, I think, a couple days after this incident happened.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Kovic. Does that conclude your comments?
Yes.
Thank you. All right, so I'll open this up for board discussion. Comments from
yes,
the board?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. I have a couple of questions, a little confused, that I'd like Dr. Kolarik to clarify. One, today, as well as during the response, you said that you conjoined contact lenses and glasses. You also said that on the 29th of December, that a comprehensive eye exam was performed, which, does your comprehensive eye exam not include the refraction?
It does with that. The comprehensive exam does not include a contact lens prescription and refraction. That's the $55 that he signed the contract for. So we charged him, I think, if I don't have his bill in front of me, $125 for his comprehensive dilated eye exam. He has some medical issues that we noted the previous year and that we're monitoring this year, but he does not have any medical insurance nor vision insurance.
So the question I have, doctor, it says if this patient were not wearing contact lenses, is the refraction part of your comprehensive eye exam?
We do a diagnostic refraction just to check the decrease in vision, which in the end, some people, let's say they're an emmetrope, no correction. Obviously, they're not charged a refraction fee, $55. But if a person elects to get glasses, they are charged $55.
Okay, well, it's still a little confusing to me because in order to determine someone is an emmetrope, he's still doing a refraction. But it does say in under your plan under item 4 on December 29th is that patient given RX for glasses. Was that written in error?
Yes, because we kind of, when we were walking out the door and we just kind of reiterated, you do want your prescription. He said, well, did it change? And we said, no, it didn't change. He said, well, then I don't need it. So, and it, I guess in error, I could have went back and said patient refused, you know, because it is their choice. And usually we would expect a contact lens wear and glasses wear a moderate myope like himself to require that, but he elected not to. And I think probably in the end, I guess it was likely due to the fact that the expense involved, maybe due to the fact he had to pay for his late 2022's eye exam also.
I don't want to belabor the point too much. I look at it, a comprehensive eye exam includes a refraction, and clearly you state you do it, but you don't give it to the patient unless they subsequently pay for it. And that in the notes, it did say that it was given to the patient. So, I can see where there could be some confusion, perhaps on a patient's part, in what a comprehensive eye exam involves. I certainly understand the additional fee when it comes to contact lenses, because that is a legitimate additional service. But on the glasses part, I had trouble understanding that you're doing services that are only paid for after the fact if they want to, but you've already completed the service.
Dr. Cole,
well,
I'm sorry if I could add.
That contract that they signed to, for the refraction and contact lens prescription, is actually before they're seen. It's not okay. Done after they're seen.
I was just going to talk about, Dr. Cohen, because I thought this might be helpful. With medical plans, of course, a refraction is not a covered service, right? But you still bill a comprehensive eye examination. With vision plan, a refraction is part of a comprehensive eye exam. And so there's difference in what insurance requires under these. In this case, this patient was self-pay, right? But if you were to look up, if you were to look up a Medicare comprehensive eye exam, it doesn't include a refraction. So
is that the 92015, I believe?
A 99202, is that right? Not 92012 for a new patient.
92014.
Yeah, what am I talking about? I was giving you intermediate codes. Yeah, so 92014. But for Medicare anyway, a refraction is not part of a comprehensive eye exam. So there's a lot of, especially in a multidisciplinary practice where you have patients coming in for, I guess more medical-oriented care, and they don't want their glasses necessarily updated every year, but that they are required to pay the refraction fee. There's a separate fee for a refraction as a procedure, as opposed to under a vision plan, a refraction is included in that. Under a medical plan, a refraction is not included in that. So there's oftentimes a separate fee for refraction if you have refraction. In addition, a lot of practices then have, so this is where I think patients get confused, and this is what's, I think, hard to understand. But a lot of times a more rudimentary refraction may be done by a technician or someone else like that. So a refraction may be in the system, but it's not necessarily performed by the doctor. And the doctor may perform the refraction then if it's a service that the patient requests or requires, but or solicits because they want to update their glasses versus, for instance, someone, let's say a diabetic presents and they've got a little change in vision and your technician does a refraction and you see an improvement in vision and then you know it's refractive as opposed to medical, right? CME or diabetic macular edema, something else causing a change in vision. The point is that medical insurance does not cover refraction as part of a comprehensive eye examination. Vision insurance does. And so I think this is the disparity that you're running into here.
Yeah, and we deal with the Medicare billing, which that is carved out in the refraction. But the question being that the service was indeed performed as per the records, it shows what the current prescription is as well as what the manifest prescription. So saying, well, the service was done as part of the comprehensive exam and only afterwards then determined whether or not the patient's going to pay for the service that was already done based on what they wanted or not.
Yeah, I'm just going to toss in there. I run into this issue all the time. Let's say that I'm sitting there with the patient and I have a refraction that my technician did. And the patient asks me, I ask them, do you want to update your glasses today? Do you have any concerns about your glasses? And the patient may say, well, did it change? And I'll look at my last refraction and the vision that I got. I'll look at their entering acuities, what they came in it with. And I'll look at the technician's refraction. And if they all look the same, I'll say, no, everything looks fine. And they say, okay, well, then I don't want it, right? They don't want that service. They don't want the time spent on my part and the fee associated with doing that procedure. So I have that conversation all the time. But then people do sometimes at the end turn around and then they say, oh, okay, well, I want that prescription. or they changed their mind on you. And so then you're trying to figure out what is it appropriate to charge for. I try never to charge. I don't ever want to charge the patient for something they're not asking for, even if I need it for medical services. So sometimes they leave the office and they say, no, they don't want it. Then they call back later. I usually just give it to them for free because I want to avoid this conversation that Dr. Kohlrick, this problem that he had with the patient, I usually just will give it away. So, but it's confusing on the part of the patient. And, you know, so those are just my thoughts. I was just trying to offer this because I feel like I experience this on a daily basis. So.
I appreciate that because that's basically, you know, the. And that's 95% of what I do. So, unfortunately, this person kind of fit in between with being a non-insured, just a cash self-pay patient. So, but I appreciate that insight.
I would offer to you, Dr. Kohlrick, in a self-pay patient that there is just a proposed, very straightforward self-pay fee, and the patient knows what that includes or does not include. And maybe in this case, the patient did, but I didn't see from your office that said what the self-pay fee would be. I just saw the separate refraction fee and contact lenses, but that might clear some of this up for you so that you don't run into it again.
I agree totally.
And Dr. Moffitt, that goes to the point that I was raising because in our practice, we do have a larger percentage of fee for service in which there is one global comprehensive fee that includes all services, including a full refraction and additional fees if they're also a contact lens patient. I know that for insurance purposes, because of what they, particularly Medicare, won't cover the fraction that we carved out and separated, mm-hmm. but it comes out to the same fee, same global fee. But for patients that are fee for service, it here's our fee for the whole exam and includes all the services we provide.
Yeah, it gets super tricky, some of this stuff. Any other comments from the board? Dr. Carpenter, any thoughts?
Yes, this is Dr. Carpenter. So I agree with what's being said. I had the same question. Obviously, this comes up a lot with Medicare patients with that separate refraction. But if you're seeing if you're billing medical insurances all day, then I could see how this would be a common occurrence. Certainly, there's been no violation of the Practice Act. You know, we could say, well, hey, you know, we need to reiterate to the patient that, hey, if you're going to get glasses or contacts within the next year, you need this. But, you know, that may or may not have been said. Like we said, even with great explanation, these things come up all the time. So I think we should move to, in fact, I make a motion, if it's okay, that we just dismiss this complaint as there's been no violation of the Practice Act.
Is there a second?
Dr. Master, I saw a second. I agree.
Any further discussion?
This is Sami Hamid. I think that I agree with everything that's been said. I think that the doctor did go above and beyond and provided the care. And I don't see a violation of the act. I think it was just obviously an honest miscommunication there, obviously, since things like this happened. It wasn't like he was a first-time patient. He's been a patient of this doctor previously. And it was just an honest miscommunication. So therefore, I agree with the comments that he said in the proposed motion.
Thank you. So we've had a motion and a second to dismiss the complaint against Dr. Kohlrick. Mr. Hamid, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Thank you, Dr. Kohlrick. Sorry, I'm out of order on my form. Make sure.
Thank you, board, for your time.
Okay, moving on to agenda item GI, Dr. Karen Grandi, related to IR number 202403. Dr. Grandi submitted 5 continuing education courses. Any concerns regarding this submittal? And does the board feel like this satisfies the board's order?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I have no concerns. It looks like she fulfilled the requirements.
Thank you. I agree.
I agree.
Dr. Brown, I agree.
Dr. Cohn, I agree as well.
Thank you, Mr. Hamed. Any concerns?
No concerns.
Thank you. Would anyone like to make a motion? I would move to accept Dr. Grande's continuing education courses submittal, and that this satisfies the board's order related to IR number 202403.
Dr. Mestaros, I'll second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay. So we've had a motion and a second to approve Dr. Grande's submittal. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestaurus?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0.
Madam President, yes. I've had a couple requests for a short break. Would you entertain a 5 to 10 minute recess before getting into the applications?
Okay. So what do we say? 9:55? We want to come back? 8 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Please, everyone, mute yourselves.
Margaret? Okay. Wonderful. All right. Let's see then. Agenda item H, review, discussion, and possible action on pending license by endorsement applications. Number one, Heather Spampinato. Dr. Spampinato had a previous record that was expunged. Any concerns about granting her licensure by endorsement?
This is Dr. Carpenter, no concerns.
Dr. Brown, no concerns.
Dr. Mestaurus, no concerns.
Dr. Cohen, no concerns.
Mr. Hamed?
No concern.
I also have no concerns. Would someone like to make a motion?
Dr. Brown, I move that we grant the license.
Dr. Mestaurus, I'll second.
Yes, we've had a motion and a second to grant the license by endorsement to Dr. Heather Spampinato. Any further discussion? Okay, we'll vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestaurus?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Agenda item I, review, discussion, and possible action on pending license by examination applications. Dr. Andrew Liu, there was significant time delay in passing the MBEO Part 1. Are there any concerns about approving Dr. Liu's licensure or application for licensure? Dr. Mestaurus.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead. I yield.
Dr. Mestaurus, this reminds me, we had a different one before, and I forget what we did with that one. but yeah, it's, I don't know.
Madam President, members of the board, if I may, Dr. Mestaurus, we did have a similar application previously. In this case, Dr. Liu took it upon himself to practice as a technician. I shouldn't say practice, to work as a technician in an ophthalmology practice. Actually, his father is the owner of one of the practices. He's an ophthalmologist, his father. So up until June of last year, he worked as a technician and then left the practice, left employment to study for the MBEO so that he could pass and get his license as an optometrist. So I just want the board to consider the applied practice that he had during employment. We did receive emails, which hopefully you all saw in the board materials, from his employers. We asked for a little more detail. We got what we got. It's very challenging to get people to, to participate in our requests these days for some reason. But I think Dr. Liu also provided a detailed explanation of his types of job duties. So if the board feels that he hasn't been out of touch so long since graduation that he would be capable of practicing the profession, you could grant him a license based on that information.
Thank you, Margaret. For my part in the discussion, I'll just say that I reviewed all the grades and then reviewed all of the examinations, and his grades looked good. And the clinical parts of the exam, he passed the first time. It was the basic sciences where he had trouble. And so I guess I always look at that, and a lot of that includes your biology, chemistry, organic chemistry, biochemistry, physics, all of the stuff from college that, and you sit for that exam, of course, you know, 2 years into your optometric education. So it's 6 years or 5 years, 4 years after you've taken some of those classes. So I knew some people who had difficulty passing MBO part one when they sat for boards too, but they were good clinicians and understood the medical side. They just maybe didn't do so well when they were younger in college. I guess that's how I looked at it. So it's not an ideal situation, but I guess I'm willing to give Dr. Liu his license.
This is Dr. Masaris. I agree. Even just the investment in taking the tests, it's a very expensive test. So this is a very motivated individual. And so I do think it would be perfect to grant him a license.
Thank you. Dr. Brown, you're up.
So I think it's very important that we do make distinctions between this case and the last one if we're going to make a different decision. And it sounds like the significant difference is the continued application of the things they can do without a license in a setting. So I think it's extremely important we acknowledge that, because we would hate to give two answers to the same condition. So go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
You're fine.
I was just going to agree with you and say that in the last case that we looked at, there was an interruption in the education side.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and so that looked really very different to me. And when you looked at the grades, there were a lot of failing classes in the optometric education. And so that really gave me a lot of pause. And then in trying to take the boards, there was a lack of a passing. In this licensee or this applicant's case, he did really very well in school. His grades in school were good. There was no interruption in the education. And he passed on the clinical side, all of the things that you do in clinical life. He passed all of those, it looked like, on the first attempt. It was only the basic sciences where he had trouble. And so this, to me, looks different. So for the record, these two things look very different to me for those reasons.
I appreciate that clarification, and I remember now and agree.
Dr. Carpenter, any thoughts here?
I agree with what's been said. I move that we approve the license application.
Okay. Do we want to second that, or do we want further discussion?
This is Dr. Connell seconded, and if I might just then add, since it's been seconded, that I appreciate the work that you did to distinguish and looking at his background to distinguish between basic science and clinical. And another distinguishing factor from the last case was that person was absent from the optometric world during that time, with this person acting as a technician, I have no doubt, did a lot of the same function and very many the same ways as a clinician would, because of their capabilities and was serving that. So there was no break in their hands-on experience working with patients, where in the prior case, there was a dearth of that.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Mr. Hamed, did you want to make any comments before we vote?
I think looking at this file and stuff that was provided, I think that, you know, when it comes to, you know, undergrad, some people don't do well in undergrad. And when it comes time to do interprofessional work at the higher level, whether it's graduate level or whatnot, they do better, actually. So I in this case, I think that he was just destined for it and very determined to pursue this field, and he did. And obviously when he did, he flourished pretty well, it looks like. So therefore, I don't have a problem granting him a license.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hamed. So we've had a motion and a second to grant Dr. Andrew Liu his license. Any further discussion? Okay, so we'll vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Agenda item J, review, discussion, and possible action on pending license by telehealth applications. So number one, Dr. Susan Daniels submitted an application for telehealth application. So I think this is maybe a little bit of a tricky topic. Dr. Daniel, at least from what I could see, wanted to be able to offer telehealth vision therapy, which I think it actually surprised me. I hadn't thought of that, but it's a very good application of the telehealth law. And so I don't have any concern about that. Her explanation and her application all looked good to me. I did have a question for Margaret about if we don't have a fee structure set up, what do we do about that?
Well, there isn't much we can do, Dr. Moffitt. It's a fee that needs to be set up in a rule, and I just haven't opened the docket to do that yet. I was waiting based on the hopeful language cleanup from last year that didn't happen. So it's definitely something on my agenda. But to answer your question more specifically, it doesn't really matter if there's a fee or not. It's a one-time registration. So, you know, the board's theoretically missing out on like a one-time registration fee, but it doesn't have any bearing on the application itself.
Okay. And then my other question was, is California considered an equivalent state for licensure with Arizona?
They are if the practitioner holds a TPG or TLG license, which is the prescribing, and she does have that. Okay. She has their highest scope.
Okay. So those are my questions. Other board members?
This is Dr. Brown. One of the observation I made was the population which she serves, and was grateful to have that possible option. We sometimes have patients from our community have to drive 2-3 hours to get services. And she says that she's going to provide the comprehensive exams from her office, but follow-ups throughout. So I have no problems with the application.
Great.
This is Dr. Masters. I agree. Do we have further information on the second one that Dr. Gomez, what he is planning to do? Or did I miss that?
I didn't bring him up.
Madam President, members of the board, Dr. Masters. No, we do not. Dr. Gomez has been a little bit challenging through the process. You know, the board is here to guide, but we don't do the work. And he just kind of said, here's some stuff. What else do I need? With all due respect, I say that I'm not trying to be disrespectful to Dr. Gomez, but the process is in place. And if the board doesn't feel there's enough information, we also did not receive the statutory agent requirement from Dr. Gomez. I mean, Fawn and I emailed him every day this week, a couple times a day. We called. He sent us to some employer that he wanted to handle it, and we just weren't able to connect. So, I mean, the board can certainly table his application.
Okay. Thank
you. You know, for whatever information they feel is missing.
Thank you,
this is Dr. Cohen. I would make a motion that we approve Dr. Susan Daniel for the telehealth application and table the application for Dr. David Gomez pending receipt of more comprehensive information, as well as the information that is yet to be submitted.
This is Sammy Hammond. I'll second it.
Okay. Any further discussion? All right. So we've had a motion to accept Dr. Susan Daniels' application for telehealth license, and we are going to table Dr. David Gomez's application for telehealth license for the time being. Mr. Hammond, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Agenda item K, review, discussion, and possible action on pending license applications awaiting fingerprint reports, requests for board approval pursuant to ARS 32-1730. So we have number one, Dr. Mark Fisher, number two, Dr. Edward Jones. Any concerns about approving Dr. Fisher and Dr. Jones' applications for licensure awaiting fingerprint reports?
Madam President, if I may, members of the board, both of these applications are 100% administratively complete. We just have not received back the fingerprint report.
Thank you, Margaret.
And this is Dr. Cohen. We have a precedent here with delays due to fingerprint, so I see no reason for us to delay this. I think they should be approved, awaiting the fingerprint report.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Other comments?
Dr. Brown, I second that motion. That was not a motion.
Okay.
Dr. Cohen, you move to approve.
Dr. Carpenter, any comments?
No comments. I formally move that we approve these applications pending the fingerprinting outcome reports.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second, Sin.
Thank you. So we've had a motion and a second to approve Dr. Fisher and Dr. Jones' license applications awaiting their fingerprint reports. Any further discussion? Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Agenda item L, Executive Director approval of new license applications pursuant to ARS 32-3123. So we have for the time period November 30th, 2023 to February 14th, 2024, new licensees A through I listed there. Agenda item M, review, discussion, and possible action on approval of Testing Center for Proctoring of Jurisprudence exam pursuant to AAC R4-21-203C. We have number one, Woodbridge Public Library System, Testing Services in Woodbridge, New Jersey. Number two, Green River College Testing Centers, Maine Auburn Center, Enumclaw and Kent, Washington, Kenton County Public Library, Erlinger Branch, Erlinger, Kentucky. Any concern about approving these centers for jurisprudence testing? Let's get everyone on the record. Dr. Mastores?
No concerns.
Dr. Brown?
No concerns.
Dr. Carpenter?
No concerns.
Dr. Cohen?
No concerns.
Mr. Hamed?
No concern.
I also have no concerns. Would someone like to make a motion?
Dr. Brown, I move we accept those testing centers.
This is Sami Hamed. I'll second it.
Thank you. So we've had a motion and a second to approve testing centers 1-3 listed here. Any further discussion? All right, Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Agenda item N. Executive Director's Report, Ms. Whalen, number one, budget.
Thank you. Madam President, members of the board, our fiscal year 24 appropriation is $289,200. That is the amount we are allowed to spend out of our fund balance. As of January 31st this year, our beginning cash balance was $576,034 with an ending cash balance of $596,223. 58.33% of the fiscal year has elapsed. Remember, we are July 1st to June 30th. The board's spending is at 56.69%. So we're right on track for remaining within the appropriated budget. One of the big issues that we've battled recently regarding the budget is the Central Services Bureau. That's part of the Department of Administration who we contract with for accounting services. The state has very specific methods and processes for accounting, as you probably know. We have an annual interagency service agreement, or ISA as we call it. It was previously $18,000 annually, and it was just bumped to $23,000. That is something that I fought on my end because I don't agree with the increase. It was a quite substantial increase. And I don't feel that the services we are getting are worth that much money. I wouldn't ever hire a full-time staff or probably even a part-time staff, maybe a quarter-time to do accounting. But because the state has such rigorous security, the accounting people have to be vetted and licensed in certain areas and things like that. But there's a new tier structure for the fees, and that's what is causing the increase to go so high, because they charge now per transaction for paying our bills and things like that. So, you know, if they process 0 to 50 invoices a year, it's $1,000. If they do 51 to 100, it's $2,000, that kind of thing. There were several areas where we were over by just one, which I really didn't want to hear, because that extra irked me because then I'm trying to find a way to, you know, lessen that and consolidate some of our, you know, our invoices, our bills. They also monitor our credit card payments, even though those are automated and go directly to the treasurer's office. CSB claims that they still do look at those for verification. So whatever the scenario, I'm not particularly happy. I'm still maybe looking at other options. But in the interim, I do have to pay that. And the increase was actually retroactive to the beginning of this fiscal year. So I felt like we should have had a year of notice, so to speak, because we have the agreement. But, you know, it's government. So they just tell us and we have to comply sometimes, even if we're unhappy. That being said, fund sweeps are back. None of you were on the board back in 2008 or 2009 when that happened, but you probably heard about it. If you're a member of the AZOA, you probably heard about it. A lot of the state associations went to bat for the regulatory boards to fight to keep our money. We are self-funded agencies. We're not in the general fund. I think our former governor's management or mismanagement of certain funds caused deficiencies in the general fund. We are called 90-10 agencies, which means we keep 90% of our revenue and we give 10% of our revenue to the general fund. So the Governor Hobbs's plan for the general fund recovery is to sweep the funds. They're not calling it a fund sweep because that's so ugly, but that's basically what it is. It's a removal of our funds. Let me pull up my list here. We are looking at, and this is just a estimate. So interestingly, I contacted the Office of Strategic Planning and Budgeting. That's the other money people that kind of govern our agency. We work with them when we have budget requests and things like that. They did not have an official list other than the 1,500-page executive budget that was put out. But I do have a list that was put in by the governor's office for a press release. And they would be looking at taking $387,000 from the State Board of Optometry. It's actually, you know, leaving us, well, they say they're leaving the agencies with enough money to continue operating. Again, not knowing what we spend to operate. I'll just say that. Last time we were swept back in 2009, they left us $40,000. So when you think about, excuse me, when you think about the fund recovery for us, you know, we've come a long way since our, you know, sweeping of $400,000 back then, leaving us with barely any money. So the, you know, the agency will continue to grow. We are built by you, the licensees. All of our money is from application fees, license fees, renewal fees. We do have other ancillary fees like, you know, licensee directories and things like that that we charge for. But again, any financial hit to the agency is always very worrisome, and sometimes that comes on the premise that, you know, they talk about the C word, as we call it, consolidation. We're still an independent board. Most of us are still independent boards. But as I move into my legislative report, you'll see that there's a little bit of consolidation going on this session. Let me pull up my staff activity here. Sorry, I just lost my report. So from December 2nd, 2023 to February 15th of 2024, we have processed 173 renewal applications. 17 new applications have been received. Of those, 7 new licenses have been issued. The others remain in deficient status, most likely, as we're waiting. At a minimum, it's kind of hard to track, but at a minimum, there's been 103 phone calls fielded, returned, voicemails that have been returned, and about 2,800, probably give or take a few emails that have been received. We are finding that as board business, mostly post-COVID, everything is email. I mean, nobody calls the office as much as they email. So we do have a heavy volume of emails, which is fine. I like everything in writing, so that works for me. Of course, our requirement under statute is that the board meet at least 6 times per year, and that's calendar year. So this is number one. So we've had 1 meeting this year so far, so we're on a roll. The legislative session update, this is the 56th legislature, 2nd regular session, which began Monday, January 8th, 2024. Yesterday was day 39 of session. To date, 1,629 total bills have been introduced, 896 in the House, 733 in the Senate, and just 1 bill signed by the governor. And ironically, I could not find what that actual bill was, so I apologize. I don't know which bill, but it was definitely not any of ours or any related to the health regulatory side. So I'm just going to, I apologize for not putting the titles of the bills. Let me actually share my screen. That way you can have that. But next month on the agenda, I will put it there for you. I want this one. Okay. Can everybody see the screen here with the list of bills? Okay. Just so you're not totally in the dark. So Senate Bill 2050 is psychologist examiners, and this would allow them to accept credentials from their association, kind of how we have our COPE and ACCME. It's kind of like that for their continuing education. Right here is the most recent action, so you can see and these are House bills. So the HB is House bill. And then it was actually transmitted to the Senate on February 12th. So, you know, it goes through the process in the House of Origin, or Chamber of Origin, and then it gets kicked out to the other one, and it goes through the exact same process, and then it goes to Committee of the Whole. And then if the bill passes both chambers, then it goes to the governor for approval or for veto, for that matter. House Bill 2072, Dental Board. There are a ton of dental board bills, so if you're interested at all in what the dentists are doing, they're always a little bit separated out from the medical professions because they're special. Dentistry is a huge profession, so and they're always under the microscope, unfortunately, for them. This one is repealing a 24-month renewal requirement and establishing it to be every year. Most boards like us are biennial renewals, so we you know, renew every 2 years. I don't know, they have a lot of money, so maybe some of this is to control the agency so that they don't have too much money, which I know sounds silly, but it's the state doesn't like the bigger boards to have, you know, huge surpluses, you know, in the $1 million. So that's usually used to control that. House Bill 2169, that is barbering and cosmetology. I have no idea why someone thought massage therapy should go under barbering and cosmetology, but there it is. So this is to actually repeal the massage therapy board as an independent board and put them under barbering and cosmetology board. It's an interesting bill from the standpoint of it's highly political, as I mean most bills are, but this one's exceptionally political, and it's kind of a done deal, as people have been told. You know, there's a lot of rumors that always go around for a session. It's always interesting to hear who's doing what. And this is one of the situations where they're just like, we're just doing it, we're moving it. Massage therapy did not have a favorable audit the last time around, but that board is also terribly understaffed. And the problems that they deal with are different than anything any of the other boards are dealing with, from the standpoint of massage therapy deals with a lot of human trafficking, sex trafficking, and prostitution. Massage therapy tends to be a cover for these type of illicit or illegal activities. So I think they have a more of a need for support from like the FBI and things like that, which they just don't get. So it's a very challenging profession to regulate. Of course, there's legitimate massage therapists. I have a massage therapy person that I see. So I'm not trying to smash the profession or bash the profession, but they have a lot of problems. House Bill 2243, the fingerprinting, criminal history and records checks. This would allow the fingerprinting board to actually review an individual, that staff would be able to review an individual's background. I don't think this would affect us because we have our own fingerprinting law, but I just thought it was interesting, and that has been transmitted to the Senate. House Bill 2279, behavioral health professionals, addiction counseling, that basically adds addiction counseling to their scope, which they didn't have before. Because those are all, a lot of those like social work style professions are either under psychologists or behavioral health. There's also behavior analysts, which are different. Psychiatrists are licensed by the medical board. They're doctors, they're MDs. So this is just another section to that profession. Dental board, the House Bill 2306, unauthorized practice, permits the Board of Dental Examiners to issue a cease and desist order on any unregistered business entity offering dental services. We already have cease and desist order. Some of you may recall have been around. There was a big issue, I think, under Governor Ducey with the cease and desist process. We have it in our law. A lot of boards did not have it in their law, so I think that's what caused the rub. So ironically, this is actually adding that into the law. A lot of that unauthorized practice stems from the North Carolina Dental Board decision, where people were wanting to sell dental equipment or dental, like wet teeth whitening and things like that. And, you know, we're told, oh, you can't, that's dentistry, that's the practice of dentistry. And the state came in and said, no, it's not. People can do that if they want to. So that opened a whole can of worms. That was years ago. That's probably been 10 years now since that board decision. But it affected the whole regulatory apple cart. So a lot of times we get these. And then I think some of you may remember recently, Mr. Hamed, probably more specifically you in the Tucson area, there was that gentleman who was cutting hair for the homeless people, but he was not a licensed barber. And the Governor Ducey made a big deal, you know, saying this man's doing good deeds. And the board said, we don't care, he's not licensed. So there was a lot of things like that. And that's what kind of goes into these bills. That's how some of these bills come about. Let's see what else. House Bill 2308, occupational licenses, criminal offense, prohibition. This requires an occupational or professional licensing board to review a properly submitted petition request for a board's denial, suspension, or revocation of a license. So if the board, any board under this law, which we would be included, were to deny a license based on criminal history, the applicant can specifically request a review just for that criminal history to be considered or reconsidered. House Bill 2312, Health Professionals website. This is a big one. This is where it increases the amount of time a health professional regulatory board has the disciplinary action available on the board's website to 25 years. It's currently 5 years. This would increase it to 25. It's always available. Public records are in perpetuity. There's no timeline as to how far back an agency can go to release a record, at least under our law. And if someone calls and wants to know about a doctor from 50 years ago, I'll provide it if I have it. but, you know, ever since the web came about and all that kind of thing, there was a law a few years ago that we can only have the disciplinary actions from 5 years or later on there. And so this would actually increase that to 25 years. I don't know what kind of impact that'll really have, but I don't care about licensed health aides. License renewal fee waiver 2473. That would require the Arizona Department of Health Services to waive a renewal fee for an associate level license if the licensee submitted the renewal application. That mostly just applies to DHS, but it's always good to see because we also have that fee waiver that Governor Ducey implemented, and that is if an applicant is below 200% of the poverty level, they can apply for a fee waiver for their application fees. That's for all the boards. House Bill 2582, pharmacists are looking at doing compacts just like the nursing board, if any of you are familiar with compacts. Optometry does not have one. It's been kicked around a little bit at ARBO, truth be told, but some of my colleagues who are on optometry but also have other professions that they are the director of because they're coming from umbrella states, they're like, don't do it. So luckily it hasn't really come to that. The discussion hasn't peaked with ARBO or in Arizona for that matter, but we'll cross that bridge when, if and when it comes here for us. House Bill 2651, cosmetology, they're lowering the number of hours required for their continuing education. It's already low in my mind, but it's not a profession I regulate, so I can't really speak to it, but I'm not a firm believer in lowering any kind of education. I'm a big fan of education as a person and as a the director of your board, so I'm always about more when it comes to continuing education. Okay, House Bill 2686, this was actually just heard yesterday. This bill is very poorly written. We had some stakeholder meetings, and I use that term loosely, with Representative Bliss. This is actually an old bill from Senator Nancy Bartow. So those of you that have been around may have remembered about 8 years ago or 5 years ago, she did the same bill. It never passed, and I think eventually was held. This is kind of a revival of the bill. It has to do with complaints that go before boards that we wouldn't be able to investigate anything else other than what is on the actual complaint. So when you think about instances where the board gets a complaint and sees something else potentially, you know, that they could at least investigate it. And it has to do with the boards having a certain time frame in which to review. Our time frames are very quick. I'm proud of our time frames. I think we're pretty efficient in that regard, but there's a number of like 180 days where the law would require that the board have some kind of adjudication, which for the big boards is impossible. And I always say the big three, which is medical, dental, nursing, that also includes actually osteopathic. There's just no way. And just like in the criminal courts or even the civil courts, administrative is no different. You know, sometimes if the respondent is represented by counsel, they're very good at continuing, and that really just draws out the process. So I think it would be impossible as a time frame. The other thing is this would actually, contradictory to the other bill, it would actually hide any disciplinary action. It would not be available to the public except upon request. It wouldn't be allowed on the website. It wouldn't be public after 5 years. There would be a 5-year limit, I think was what they were looking at. So if someone had a really, let's see, egregious, I mean, most complaints, you know, that are dismissed are not, but the ones that have been disciplined, you know, if it's past 5 years, I can't reveal that to the public. Well, as a consumer, how would you make an informed decision as to whether or not you want to see a practitioner based on their history? This is absolutely a bill that protects the profession and protects the trade associations. That's who was there yesterday to testify. It was all trade associations. My colleagues and I agreed that we would send a letter, which we did, to Representative Montenegro. He's the chair, and also to Representative Bliss. We've been working very closely with her. It did receive a due pass recommendation, 6-4. So 60 A's, 4 nays, which is great from the standpoint of there's some wiggle room there. It wasn't unanimous by any means. So that was at least, you know, we have more work to do. But this is definitely a bill that the boards are opposing. And if you feel so inclined as independent practitioners, you're more than welcome to sign in and, you know, oppose the bill after reading it. But there is a lot in this bill that is not good. And it's, like I said, very similar to Bartow's bill. And that bill didn't pass. So we're hoping that if it does get through both chambers, that the governor will veto it. So, I mean, that would be the absolute last. You don't ever want it to get that far. But in the event that it does, we're hoping that it gets vetoed. So keep an eye on that one, particularly 2686. I'll skip down to 2739 here, homeopathic board repeal. So this is one of the boards that the lobbyists are looking at. Actually, it's the Common Sense Institute, and there's another one called Republican Free Institute or something like that. These are both bills that are sponsored but have like 15 co-sponsors. That's highly irregular to have that many co-sponsors. But these two, actually 2740 also, homeopathic would go under, they're already under acupuncture board, but they would go under naturopathic. So we would be looking at a consolidation of homeopath, acupuncture, and naturopathy. Those would be consolidated. This next bill, 2740, very upsetting. I think that the dispensing opticians in this state need to be regulated. And they just had their audit and sunset review, and they received the maximum 8 years continuation just in 2022. So the fact that someone is coming back this session and trying to repeal, it's a little bit shady as a practice. And, you know, what it means is that if they repeal their statutes and their rules, the agency no longer exists because they have no authority to do anything. So that's sort of the sneaky way to do it. I got a call from Ms. Megan Darian. She's the executive director and my colleague. She met with Representative Hendricks yesterday or late the day before. And the buzz is that they do want to actually move them under optometry board. So I'm not sure what that would look like. You know, sometimes they come over as an independent board that gets attached to us, and we would have separate funds and things like that, or they would just merge them in and say, now you're regulating both. I respectfully say I don't want dispensing opticians. I think it's a conflict of interest. We are a completely different profession. I think people just assume, oh, well, they do eyes also, but they do glasses. They don't do anything, you know, medically with the eyes. So still in the early stages, and Ms. Darian's working really hard. She had a meeting with her. Several of her board members came and talked to Representative Hendricks. So I don't think he's very receptive, but again, that's a bill that you would want to oppose if you were looking to log in and do that. And the board would definitely oppose that bill. I would like the board to oppose that bill. Senate Bill 1021. Sorry, I know this is always the longest part, the first beginning of the year. I appreciate your patience. Oh, 1021, let's see. Removes the definition of increase the scope of practice as it is applied to the health professional group. Let's see, actually, I don't think that's. Never mind, that doesn't affect us. Sorry. I had looked at these before before today, but I
sorry to interrupt, Margaret. What does held mean when it says held?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Mastoris. Held means that the sponsor most likely held the bill. So when a sponsor becomes aware that the bill isn't getting support, either by their colleagues or you know, by associations or by opposition, they can hold the bill so that it doesn't die. They'll just wait until either an opportune time to submit it later in the session, or it may never get resubmitted. Like, actually, that's what happened to ours last year. It was held, and then it just never got put back into the flow. But that just means that it's being held for some reason until something can get sorted out, some part of the bill or some political piece to it. But usually it's because it doesn't have support, or it has too much opposition. Let's see. So here we see again the homeopathic. Well, it's interesting because they're on one hand repealing, but then here they're updating the qualifications of a homeopath. I feel like there's only like 40 some licensed homeopaths in the state. It's a very tiny profession. Most of them are also MDs. So they're like MD/HMD. So they just have a derivation into homeopathy. Senate Bill 1200, the veterinarians are adding malpractice into their unprofessional conduct law. It currently isn't. Same thing here, complaints, records, and specialists. It's interesting because, you know, human medicine, of course, very different, but all the regulatory boards function in a very similar fashion. So, you know, the fact that the veterinary board doesn't have, you know, we have this already where you can't hold yourself out to be a specialist. So they're adding that to their law, and the malpractice as an unprofessional conduct. Chiropractic is having their own, right here, Senate Bill 1233, they're having their own complaint investigation process added to their law. But again, they would fall under that Senate Bill or House Bill 2686. So the interesting part about this session is there's a lot of individual bills that do the same thing as some of the bills that are overarching to all the health regulatory boards. So we'll see what happens, because sometimes when there's duplicate bills, that actually helps the process, because then none of them get passed because the governor doesn't like that, any governor, not just this governor, but the governor doesn't usually want to have to deal with all these different angles. They're like, what's the deal? Do we want it? Yes or no? Is it going to be beneficial to, you know, my citizens of Arizona? Which in most cases, the answer is no. At least in these cases, I'll say that. Psychologists are looking to add prescribing authority, which I find super interesting. I'm sure they're counterparts of the psychiatrists are not super excited about that. Let me just find my summary here. Yeah, actually, it's part of a collaborative agreement that they have. So it would monitor the prescribing by psychologists and determine if it's actually unprofessional conduct or incompetency if they prescribe. When not licensed to prescribe. So I find that one super interesting. Senate Bill 1267, physical therapy assistance and student supervision. I feel like this one removed the requirement. Let's see. Removes the requirement that a physical therapist be in the facility when a physical therapy student or assistant is present. So I'm not sure how that works. You know, optometry doesn't have supervisory or internships or anything like that. So I don't know why they would remove that. If I'm a consumer patient, which I am, I'd be a little nervous to find out that there's no actual licensed person on the premises. But that bill, let's see. Actually, it's already been, so it's working its way through the Senate, so it hasn't even finished the process as of the 13th. So we'll see. Sometimes bills move really fast, too. That's the other interesting thing. Bills will move fast, so everyone gets all in a tizzy, and then it will come to a screeching halt, and it will never be heard from again. So that's why legislative session is so interesting, because it could go either way up until the absolute last minute. Those of you that have been around in 2015, when we had the licensed physician removed from our board. That was actually a bill that we fought really hard for, and so did ophthalmology, even though it just said it had to be a physician. It didn't say an ophthalmologist, but it was coincidentally always an ophthalmologist. That bill was dead, and actually Don Isaacson from the lobbyist for the association, the AZOA, got it moved to Commerce Committee. It was heard in Commerce Committee and it passed and the governor signed it. So, you know, stuff like that happens, and that's kind of the fun of session, if you will. It's not over till it's over. So any of our bills could come and go. Let's see, Senate Bill 1634 exempts non-health professional regulatory boards from an administrative law judge's decision as it pertains to administrative hearings. So again, we're health regulatory, but I just wanted to put in there because, again, it seems like why wouldn't the non-health regulatory boards? Because to me, regulation is regulation. I know it's not quite that simple, but, you know, it kind of is. And it's from the standpoint of, like, if you are regulatory, you're responsible for very specific things, and you should have the same processes regardless if you are health or non-health. So, sorry, I know I was talking really fast. That was a lot of information, but I wanted to just give you kind of an overview of some of the bills that I'm watching, That's definitely not a comprehensive list, but it is most of them. Future agenda items. Does anybody have any future agenda items that they would like to see on the next board meeting?
This is Dr. Mastoris. Do we agendas devise potentially like having a telemedicine license and license fee? Or is that like we can't do that?
Yes. So yes, we can. I think I'm trying to remember if we had previous discussion. I don't think we ever discussed what the fee itself would be. So we definitely should do that because I'm preparing actually just to open a docket for rules, because you can open a docket and then it could sit there for like a year, which I should just do that so that we can, you know, kind of talk about some rules and things. But yes, I will add that as a future agenda item. Thank you, Dr. Mastoris. Anybody have any other future agenda items?
I was just going to ask, did we miss the 2023 legislative advice memo from Ms. Baskin? Was
there did. I am so sorry. Yes, thank you. Ms. Baskin, would you like to jump in? I apologize.
Oh, that's fine.
And to the board. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam President, members of the board. This is a very short advice memo. It's from last session. As far as the Senate Bill 1270, it's not really available to the sports. It's all of our meetings are virtual.
I'm sorry. I can't. I'm having a hard time hearing you. Sorry. I apologize for interrupting, Dr. Brown.
Hold on, Dr. Brown. Can you hear me now, Dr. Brown?
That's better. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, I had some headphones in. I was having some problems with them, so. I apologize. Okay. All right. Turning back to the first one, it's an open meeting law capacity. This basically provides that there must be sufficient seating for a reasonable anticipated attendance. It doesn't apply to this board. However, should this board have maybe an in-person meeting, you know, once a year, it would, but we have remodeled hearing room boardrooms, so we do have capacity and we do have chairs. The next one is Senate Bill 1333, and it basically deals with reporting requirements for to DHS. It requires the board to report revocations. And there's a portion in here about whether or not if the board accepted a voluntary surrender of a license, you know, how would that factor in? And I guess we will cross that bridge when we come to it. When we take a look at the board's regulations, you do not have the authority to accept a voluntary surrender. That isn't under your statute. You have the ability under ARS 3217.43 to impose a censure, a civil penalty, probation, suspend, or revoke. However, what boards do, should an individual be in this position, they would voluntarily surrender their license, and pursuant to a term of the agreement, it would state in the document that it would be considered a revocation pursuant to this subsection and for all other purposes. So that's how it will be handled by this board. Other boards actually do have a disciplinary sanction, that is the voluntary surrender of an individual's license. All health boards, you know, non-health boards are different as far as what they have as far as disciplinary options. So that is how that would be addressed. So not much happened last year, pretty quiet year. I know that this year there's, you know, Margaret just went, Ms. Whalen went through a lot of the pending bills, but at the end, we'll see how it all shakes out. So unless anybody has any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mona. And again, I apologize. I was so excited to get into legislation. I forgot that you had last year's legislative report. Real quickly, back to the future agenda items. So I just have the telehealth application registration fee. Are any other agenda items that anyone would like for the next board meeting?
I have Dr. Brown here. I have one observation. You were talking about the possible sweeping of funds. Mm-hmm. And I remember the discussion, I believe it was in 2015 when our fees were raised, and there were concerns expressed that we're raising fees only to be swept. do we need to look at reducing fees to have less swept? Is that any, I'm just a question.
It's a great question, Dr. Brown. Thank you. And that is the first question everybody always asks, you know.
It's not on the agenda. It's just to identify as an agenda item. So let's not have substantive discussion.
Got it.
Yes. Thank you, Mona. So I can definitely add that for the next month. I mean, we can certainly have a discussion. Let's see, Laura.
I was going to raise how our training levels look. Maybe we should look into that for each year.
The board member training?
The board member training, yeah. Just to see where we are. And
okay. Got it. Anything else?
Yeah, this is Dr. Cohen. Where do things stand in terms of end of any particular board member's terms? Is that coming up in discussion soon?
We don't usually discuss that particularly, Dr. Cohen, but I believe two people are due to expire this June.
Expiring? Oh, no.
The terms are. Excuse me. Hopefully the people are not. I will look into that and actually just send out an email with the current terms so that everyone can decide if they want to be reappointed by the governor or not. I think all of you were appointed under the previous governor, so it'll be interesting.
I had reapplied, Dr. Messaris, but I haven't heard back yet.
Yeah,
right. I was last July.
Yeah, thank you for continuing to serve. It ends up being, you know, just, I mean.
I'm sorry, I'm gonna stop.
I know, no discussion. Okay, moving on. Okay, future board meeting dates. I have, I did not plan on meeting next month. I thought we would do April 5th and June 7th as tentative future board meeting dates. Is everyone available on April 5th at this time? I think if board business dictates, you know, I may ask for a meeting prior to that, but since it's already the middle of February, I think April 5th is fine. But Madam President, members of the board, it's completely up to you.
April 5th is fine with me.
Mona?
April 5th is fine for me, but I have a full day hearing on April 3rd for the agenda. But we can talk about that offline.
Okay.
April 5th is fine with me.
Thank you, Mr. Hamid.
I can also do April 5th.
Okay. Anybody else? Dr. Brown, Dr. Carpenter, Dr. Cohen, you'll check your
Dr.
schedules.
Dr. Carpenter, I'm fine on the 5th.
Okay.
Yep. Both dates work for me.
Dr. Brown is available on the 5th.
All right. I appreciate that. Well, then let's plan on April 5th as our next public meeting. And that, Madam President, concludes my director's report. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Agenda item O, call to the public. Any members of the public that would like to address the board? Okay. And then agenda item P, motion to adjourn. Would anyone like to offer a motion to adjourn?
Dr. Brown, I move for adjourn.
I was like, nobody?
Is there a second?
Go on a second, Matt.
Thank you. Any further discussion? So we've got a motion and a second to adjourn the meeting. Mr. Hamid, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastoris?
Aye.
I also vote aye. The motion passes 6-0. This concludes this February 16, 2023 meeting of the Arizona State Board of Optometry.
At 10:54 a.m.?
At
10:53. Thank you so much, Dr. Moffitt. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you in April.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.